relationships, although I will say that I was part of a somewhat unsuccessful union campaign for the house staff at Montefiore Medical Center in the last couple of years. So this slide is the labor movement, the folks that brought you all of those nice things that we take for granted, unemployment insurance, the weekend. And this talk is based on a paper that's currently in revision and that seeks to highlight the historical context of physician unionization and to analyze, in light of that history, some of the challenges and potential benefits of and goals of unionization. I should also say that, in addition to my disclosure, the opinions expressed here definitely do not reflect or represent the opinions of Montefiore Medical Center or Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I'm not here as a representative on their behalf, although I would love to say that I was. These learning objectives are there for you to see, and I want to say first that I'm not going to suggest here today that a physician union is a panacea to the ills of corporate medicine, because it's certainly not, and we'll review some of the reasons why. However, I will propose that unions offer a counterbalance to forces that seem increasingly beyond our control and hazardous to the public health. So, what are these forces? So this is a cartoon depicting corporate medicine turning a screw into the back of a patient. And we've heard a little bit about what that's like today, but I think I'll just say briefly that the fiduciary responsibility of corporations is to its shareholders. And so in a healthcare corporation, the patient will never come first, and neither will public health. And we have all the health indicators in this country to prove that. I'm sure most of you are aware of them. One effect of this corporatization, and there have been many, has been economic. So the incomes of physicians have either declined in real terms or the growth of physicians' incomes has declined. And, you know, it may be difficult to feel sympathy in this country for anybody who's likely to earn over $150,000 a year, given the average income of this country being less than $50,000. But the average physician emerges from medical school with nearly $200,000 in loan debt, which when paid off in a time frame that allows us to support a family, it can be much larger. It also has an effect on people going into medical school. A second effect of this corporatization has been administrative, which has resulted in a decline in physician autonomy and the rise of an administrative class, which is just another level of bureaucracy in healthcare. And a third effect has been the driving of physicians into employment care settings. So what you see here is a slide which depicts U.S. physician ownership. And in 2002, physicians owned approximately 70% of physician practices in this country, and hospitals owned somewhere over 20%. And as you can see, by 2008, it had switched, and hospitals actually owned more than 50% of physician practices in this country. Similarly, in 2000, around 8% of specialists and around 18% of physicians, primary care physicians, were employed by hospitals, and that number continues to rise, as you can see. So to go back to this, so it's interesting to me that some of the rhetoric that's been used over the years, often by those who insist that we have the best healthcare system in the world, is that the physicians over there, being anywhere else, are too regulated. And this argument fits into a worldview in which regulation is an automatic condition of a government project. And the logic says something like, you are a government-employed physician, so you can only do what the government tells you to do. And there's two things I'd like to say about this image. One is that patients have many barriers to overcome to obtain meaningful health care, especially for the growing un- and underinsured in this country, which is now more than the 45 million depicted there. The second is that while it depicts the building that the providers inhabit at the very top where it says healthcare, it's the machinations beneath, really, run by all the people that you see there that make us the most heavily regulated physicians in the world. And the greatest problem with this system of regulation is its unpredictability, its instability, and its genuine orientation towards denying care rather than providing it. So I bring up the AMA next to suggest that in this context, because the AMA has not been part of the solution, it's really part of the problem. And I don't know what to say about a so-called representative voice of physicians that has in its membership a small and declining percentage of American physicians. and its politics have been historically dangerously conservative at worst, insubstantial at best, and historically opportunistic, which is something that I believe runs contrary to the idealistic nature of our profession. And all of this has resulted in unhappy, disillusioned physicians. And just referring to my own personal experience, I haven't forgotten how in the years before I applied to medical school, most physicians I encountered encouraged me not to go into medical school. And it's important that we recognize that this is an unsustainable proposition to decrease the number of people entering the healthcare field, especially while we have a shortage of primary care doctors in this country as it is. So what are we to do about unhappy healthcare workers? This sign says we care about patients. Who cares about us? And I'd like to transition here to talking about the history of unionization, because physicians have been asking this question for a long time. And when physicians have tried to care for themselves, it has often coincided with unionization. So physicians are comprised of fully qualified, licensed attending physicians and also physicians in training, which are the interns and residents. And it was with them, really, that the history of physician unions begins. And this is a picture here that I don't have a pointer, but of Bellevue Hospital in the top left, which is a New York City public hospital in which the interns where in the 1930s the interns began to advocate for improved working conditions. Specifically, they were concerned about lack of salaries, lack of teaching rounds, and certain dangerous working conditions. The intern physicians used to have to ride in the back of the ambulance, which occasionally didn't have a door and didn't have a seat belt, and there were times when they'd be thrown out the back. So the Intern Council of New York was founded in the 1930s. It would go through several iterations, and at each step they advocated successfully for improved wages and benefits, workmen's compensations, and improved medical libraries, or upgrading of medical libraries. This and organizations that followed suit in places like Boston, Chicago, and Los Angeles at their public hospitals were outspokenly progressive and supported national health insurance and later an end to discriminatory practices. Now, the AMA was not happy with these organizations. They linked them with communism, political expediency, trade unionism, and idealism. All isms that some progressive physicians would find flattering. Still, their efforts had a real and toxic effect on physician unions, and in 1950, the AMA sent a letter to every single intern in the country entitled Leftist Minority Woos Future Doctors, which highlighted a study conducted by the AMA that found that the Association of Interns and Medical Students, which was one of the larger physician union groups at the time, advocated, quote, the overthrow of the U.S. government by force and violence, favors strikes upsetting to medical education, and exhibits communistic tendencies and affiliations. So they had a decline in the 50s and 60s. But in the late 60s and 70s, like for many young people, this was a period of activism for house staff organizations, among them the Committee on Interns and Residents, which was founded in 1958 and is currently the largest U.S. house staff union. They advocated for community health projects, civil rights, opposition to the Vietnam War, and for local hospital issues such as house staff patient loads, staff shortages, and improved social services and patient care issues. And in 1971, the student AMA had a national conference to discuss the issue of physician unionization. It was sponsored by the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and by the Department of Social Medicine at Montefiore Medical Center, where attendees adopted positions on a broad spectrum of health issues, including community participation in health policy, patients' rights, women's rights, foreign medical graduate rights, and a model contract for house staff. So over the years, house staff unions have worked with medical student groups, most predominantly the American Medical Student Association, to bring potential for advocacy to medical students. And as you've heard, house staff unions have been overwhelmingly progressive, which contrasts somewhat with unionization by attendings. So, as some of you have probably experienced firsthand, physicians were traditionally small businessmen. They were entrepreneurs running their own practices. And the two principal threats to which attending physicians have responded by attempting to unionize have been managed care and socialized medicine. The major threat that theoretically was posed to them was a decline in income. And the Union of American Physicians and Dentists, whose logo is here, was formed in 1972 with the principal goal of improving doctors' pay. Now, one of the challenges that all of these physicians came up against was the Sherman Antitrust Act, which in basic terms made it illegal to form a cartel, which is what you call a collection of organizations who collude to fix the prices of certain goods or services, which is exactly what the physicians were trying to do in the face of managed care. And a second challenge that these unions faced is one that all physician unions have faced, which is the organizational and financial challenges that it takes to overcome and have the kind of reach a union needs to be effective. And to that end, physicians have affiliated with larger unions. So CIR, or the Doctors' Council, which is one of the larger attending physician unions, is affiliated with SEIU, like CIR. And UAPD is affiliated with the American Federation for State, Civil, and Municipal Employees Union. So that's in the U.S. Internationally, physician unions are kind of the rule rather than the exception. And you have the British Medical Association, which is a very large and effective trade union organization. The Indian Medical Association is Israeli Medical Association, Finnish Medical. You can read them; they're all there. Each of the Canadian provinces has their own union. So now let's transition to talk about barriers to unionization. Oh dear, pardon me. So the first one, and in light of a discussion about international unions, the U.S. is unique in its need for certification by a government agency, and that's the National Labor Relations Board, which is depicted here in this editorial showing a boot trampling on union rights. But the NLRB is actually an instrument of the executive branch. Its appointees have a more or less friendly approach to unions depending on who's in power. So while Bush the Younger was in office, the NLRB was relatively anti-union, and unions during that time didn't really seek to push the envelope on growth or issues. And then the Obama presidency has been largely considered to be an opportunity for unions to expand. And there are at least two unresolved issues that are relevant in this discussion regarding the National Labor Relations Board. One is that is the debate about the status of house staff physicians as either workers or students. And anybody who's been a resident in this room or known a resident likely understands how absurd a question it is about whether or not a resident is a worker or a student. And the other issue which unions feel may be pushed by hospital corporations is the idea that all physicians in the corporation must unionize together, and that includes the residents and the attendings, which is also absurd because they'd be fighting almost for completely different things in some ways. They have different issues. So it's important to recognize that the unions themselves may be a barrier. For one, public opinion has turned on unions. From industrial unions to teachers, they are perceived as self-serving, overindulgent, greedy, and bullish. And in some cases, it seems clear that unions have become more about self-sustenance, benefit overreach, and uncompetitive work practices as anything else. And as this graph shows, public approval of unions is at its lowest in 80 years. And disapproval is at its highest, disapproval being the light green one on the bottom. And what's so interesting to me about the rhetoric around Wisconsin public union workers as came up last year was that people were saying that the public health workers had it too good. They didn't need unions because the conditions of their work were so good, completely blowing past the fact that the reason they had it so good was because they had unions. And the same is really true of American baseball players who make just amounts of money that are too absurd to mention here, and other professional athletes. Finally, when we attempted to unionize last year at Montefiore, as we progressed, the heads of both 1199, which is the largest hospital worker union in the country based in New York City, and SEIU, the parent union, called the head of CIR, who was a cardiology fellow at the time. Okay. To say that they could not support our efforts because they were made to believe by the hospital corporation that it would undermine their long-term collaboration with the hospital. Now, SEIU has a very, or 1199 has a very cozy relationship with the hospitals in New York City, which should raise questions about the efficacy of the union. Okay, so that's SEIU. Stronger together or not. So physicians. So one of the barriers that's presented itself for physicians is the idea of professionalism, and one of the long-standing criticisms within medicine about unionization is that it's unprofessional. And just to review, professionalism is considered to be the basis of medicine's contract with society. And a definition that I like is that it's an activity that involves both the distribution of a commodity and the fair allocation of a social good, but that is uniquely defined according to moral relationships. It's a stabilizing force and often referred to in terms of behavior. And in practice, it's associated with behaviors related to patient care that usually involve a burden on the one who is providing the care. So the anti-professionalism argument stems from three things. One is the work behavior of other unionized workers, which is often seen in healthcare settings as obstructive to the completion of good work. That includes a feeling that work is defined in terms of what one cannot or will not do. In addition, studies have shown that anti-union physicians believe that unions tolerate incompetence and increase the deprofessionalization of medicine. They may find as well that the traditional union focus on seniority is antithetical to a meritocratic society. Excuse me, culture. The second is the idea of industrial action. The power of a union exists because of its ability to withhold work or to strike. And as physicians' work involves the care of the sick, it's seen as professionally and morally reprehensible to withhold that good. But I'd just say that this hasn't stopped physicians from unionizing, both in this country and elsewhere. And there was a very large physician strike in Israel last year where they were fighting over working conditions and pay. And it hasn't had a tremendously bad effect on the public health. There was a study done of a 35-day strike in Los Angeles in 1976 where they looked at mortality. They were expecting it would have gone up during the physician strike. It actually went down. They proposed that it might be because of the number of elective procedures went down, which is another topic altogether. But strikes aren't the only form of industrial action. We can also do things like not fill out paperwork, which prevents the hospital from billing and things like that. And importantly, in all of the strikes over the years, essential services have been maintained. Essential services being emergency services and hospitalized patients. So a third barrier is class. Okay, so I'll just say briefly that physicians have generally considered, society has generally considered unionism to be a blue collar affair, and which doesn't go with the white coat. And there's perceived to be a lack of status. Some anti-union physicians have claimed that the idea of unionization enforces the perception that physicians are laborers, as if it didn't feel that way. And a final barrier is the way the American physicians have developed loyalty more to their professional associations than to the larger body of physicians as a whole. So why should physicians unionize now? On the right, it says there will be a bit of a wait while we figure out a market solution to your problem. That's in the emergency room. And then the Physician Protection and Affordable Care Act, with which physicians had nothing to do. So I just want to say that there's reasons that include economic reasons, which are to increase the salary and benefits, a professional model, which is to really take back the idea of professionalism and say that the current model of care has actually diminished professionalism as well as clinical autonomy. And related to this idea is one that unions are a mechanism for collective voice, which allow their employees to express in unison their preferences to management. So what should we be asking for? And I'll be quick here. The first thing is transparency. People are probably familiar with the idea of the black box, which hospital corporations, like most corporations, rely on to obscure what happens behind closed doors. And I'll just give you a brief example. I work at a federally qualified health center that receives money from the government for both its federally qualified work as well as patient-centered medical homework. And this gets absorbed into the larger hospital corporation, and we are constantly told that we do not have enough money to provide essential services to the people that we care for, when in fact we know that our clinic is profitable. And this is not an uncommon situation. And meanwhile, our physicians are amongst the lowest paid in the country, and our hospital CEO makes $5 million a year. So we're asking for a voice. Unions will often say that if you are not at the table, then you are on the menu. And I think that is true. We need a successful platform for healthcare reform, and we might be able to advocate for more primary care and less student debt, which keep people from going into medicine in the first place. So that's really it. I'd like to suggest that unions are a viable alternative to the corporate healthcare model, at least as the counterbalancing force. So thank you very much.